Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to another podcast about palliative care. I'm David Oliver. I'm an honorary professor at the University of Kent and a member of the management group of the specialty panel in palliative care. And today we'd like to talk about Parkinson's disease. I'm very pleased to have Dr. Ed Richfield, who is a consultant in care of the elderly in Bristol and has had a lot of experience in the care of people with Parkinson's disease. Welcome.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me on.
What we'd like to talk about, how the role of palliative care is for Parkinson's disease. What do you feel is the role of palliative care for people with Parkinson's disease and their families?
Thanks. Yeah, well, it's very wide-reaching potentially, isn't it? It's changed a lot in the last few years. And so I suppose there's a question of what the role is currently and how that's operationalised in different settings and what the role could be, because I suspect that in most areas, we are not utilising it yet to its full potential. And that is, I think, partly because our understanding has changed and levels of acceptance have changed, both within the profession and also within the population generally. So we'll still find pockets where people are using rather outdated definitions of palliative care and still thinking of it as being around just dying. And as we move away from that, then we're increasingly utilising palliative care and palliative care approaches to its full sort of potential. And that's where we need to head, I think, for this population. So, and I think there are specific aspects, for Parkinson's disease, even with the very limited approach, you know, even if one was to focus on death and dying and the end of life, there are aspects of care for people with Parkinson's disease which require specific thought. You know, how might one manage stiffness at the end of life? Are we sure that we're recognising dying appropriately and not, in, particularly in a hospital setting, not over-diagnosing dying when people actually are under-treated or have intercurrent illness? How do we manage Parkinson's medications at home? How do we help colleagues in a hospice incorporate Parkinson's disease and its medications into their management so that people get equal access? So even if we took a very limited definition of palliative care, I think there are PD specific issues to address. But I imagine I don't have to convince you that taking a wider approach potentially opens up a much greater scope of work and potential. And actually, if we look at some of the research, you know, there's evidence from the States accepting that their population, their healthcare system has particular differences to Europe, but that actually people with Parkinson's disease are very varied in their willingness to or desire to engage with palliative care, which means that, you know, 25% of people almost were wanting to discuss end of life issues and advanced care planning right from those early consultations. So actually, if we take a whole disease approach, then there are roles right from the beginning. There are roles in helping people to assimilate information, helping people to cope with their disease, because there are very clear differences in the qualitative literature in the way that people use information to help them cope with their disease. Some people being information gatherers, and that being a very important coping strategy. There are roles around helping people come to terms with the fact of diagnosis and what that means for them and the losses along the journey. And I'm sure everyone who cares for people with Parkinson's disease would recognise that life course is often punctuated by periods of loss, whether that be social or physical or spiritual or psychological. And of course, caregiver support, etc. Sorry, that's a very long answer. But so I think that wider view really gives us a much greater potential for palliative care to have benefit. It also opens up a wider conversation about how we meet those needs and how that expands beyond the definition of who gives who does palliative care, because by definition you're then taking a whole disease approach.
Thank you very much. I mean, do you see the neurologist or the elderly care physician or the general physician as providing a lot of this palliative care, looking at people from their physical, psychological, social and spiritual aspects? Should we all be involved in providing palliative care throughout the disease process?
Thank you. Yes, I think is the quick answer, isn't it? Do I ever give quick answers? I don't know. I think it's inevitable, isn't it? Because it isn't feasible to take a whole disease approach and ask that to be delivered by specialist palliative care. It just can't happen. It isn't possible. Never mind the fact that it isn't desirable, because there are significant advantages to some of these things being delivered by the usual care team, because you have that longevity of relationship with the patient. As a neurologist or nurse specialist or geriatrician looking after people with Parkinson's disease, you have a high level of specialist knowledge about the medications and the disease itself, which you can't necessarily transplant into your palliative care colleagues in the same way that they can't transplant their expertise into us. So I think it's inevitable that taking that wider approach requires everybody to play their part. The really interesting question, I think, is what that means in practice, and the balance of different types of care for different people, how that changes over time as teams learn from each other. And I think we're increasingly moving towards an understanding of that. There are some principles to guide us, but actually often that will look, I think, different locally, maybe even, you know, even within the same geographic region. You know, even I'm working in Bristol and colleagues are working in, for example, Bath, which is sort of 30 miles down the road. And you may find that there are differences in the way that has to be operationalized, because it depends on the skills of the team, the makeup of the team, the resources that are available. So I think we start from the principles of what we're trying to deliver, and then there's quite a detailed conversation potentially about who can do what, whose skills are suited to this, how do we create a system that helps us to deliver those aspects of care.
Thank you. Certainly during these podcasts, we've talked of the collaboration between neurology and neurology services and specialist palliative care services, and that neurologists can provide general palliative care, and that approach to patients, listening to them, talking with them, working on their symptoms, helping with advanced care planning and preparing for end of life, perhaps in collaboration with specialist palliative care. Are there particular areas during the disease progression where we should all be aware of potential needs, whether they're symptoms or psychological or caregiver needs? Are there particular areas that we all ought to be aware of?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think that's a really interesting question. And I think that our understanding of this will grow. I think we probably can even now map out some time points. So we know that diagnosis is a very challenging period. People with Parkinson's have often had a long lag period living with symptoms before they're recognised, even living with motor symptoms, never mind the fact that we know the premotor symptoms, of course, may have been there for many years. So I think the diagnosis itself actually is a time of which requires considerable care based on people's expectation of that diagnostic consultation. What were they going into the room thinking about? Some people will have almost decided themselves they've got Parkinson's disease, and their response to that diagnosis will be very different to someone who's going in there with no idea of what's going to happen in the consultation. We know that, for example, the non-motor features of Parkinson's are very burdensome for people, so having a consideration to those would be very important. We know that the onset of Hoehn-Yahr stage 3 with axial instability is associated with a step change in quality of life and increased caregiver needs. So we could start to build up this pattern. There's some evidence to guide us in terms of times when disease trajectory might start to be more progressive, progressive towards the more complex and eventually palliative phase of the disease. That's using a very medical model, but I think, for our medical brains, that's one way of looking at it. I think there's a really key question about how we respond to the information coming out of the cohort studies that have been running for some time now, and our increased understanding that gives us prognostically. People will be familiar with the existence of at least two that I know of, models for trying to predict outcome in Parkinson's disease, used in a research context. But, increasingly we have an idea of people who have a worse prognosis. And for me, that creates a potential big power imbalance across the consultation desk, if people still use those, whereby I may be sitting in clinic and recognize a cluster of symptoms and signs and think, gosh. And the question, I think, the challenge to myself is, how do I respond to that? And am I open to understanding the patient's needs around information and around planning for the future? So I think as our understanding of prognostic information changes, we'll increasingly be less able to hide behind this sort of pluralistic approach of, oh, no one knows what the future holds, varied. Actually, increasingly we will do. And then actually, I'm sorry for the long answer again, David. I think there's an even more interesting patient-centered approach, which is about understanding the important patient milestones along the journey. It can sound slightly trite to think about those in a generalized way, because obviously people are individuals. So I think we can have some framework in our head in terms of losses. What are the losses that are occurring along the way? I think of people who are talking about moving house because they think they might need a bungalow, so they're leaving the house they've been in for many years, or losing their job, or giving up driving. I think those are true. They are important points for people. And then actually we go even a level deeper to that. And having a longevity of relationship with a patient, I think hopefully allows us to know them well enough that actually we start to recognise what's important to them specifically and the losses for them along the way. I couldn't write my Christmas cards this year, which was really important to me because that's how I keep in touch with my long lost friends. And it's not to say that each of those points necessarily needs a specific palliative intervention, but to say that there may well be, I think, times along that life course where someone's openness to considering the future and openness to palliative intervention is higher, and their potential for palliative need is higher. And so that should challenge us as clinicians to say, have I thought about it? Have I been open to it? Maybe have I applied a screening tool, if that's what you want to do? I don't think many people are doing that yet, but there's potential for that. But mostly, have I been listening properly? Have I heard the upward inflection in the voice? And have I responded appropriately? Because I think we'll all have been in situations where we get a hint of that. And again, that power dynamic, the way that, we can guide the conversation. And did I take the opportunity to guide the conversation in the area that was going to take me an extra 10 minutes? Was I?
I think that's one of the realities.
I think those are. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
Do you think, you mentioned screening tools, do you think there is going to be an increasing role for people, perhaps before a clinic appointment on a regular basis, completing a very basic assessment, patient response, so that you are aware of what may be becoming issues to people?
Potentially. I think there's so many tools, aren't there, in Parkinson's disease, and so few of them, I think, that are used in practice. I mean, in our locality, we do, for example, the non-motor symptom questionnaire pre-clinic. And whilst that's not a palliative care tool, it'll give you an idea about the important symptoms for people, which is pretty important and clearly linked to palliative care need, because one could go one step beyond that. I've got really bad bladder urgency. Okay, well, what does that mean in terms of other things? So I think that's feasible. There are some tools which are clinician facing rather than patient facing. And I think we can have some idea about how we could utilize tools. So I think in a general PD consultation or a general neurology clinic, something which is rapidly completed by the clinician to say, I'm worried about, to prompt them to think I'm worried about this is probably feasible. Something that involves asking patients a series of questions, I think probably isn't, unless we have very different structures. So it may be that those tools are better placed as the next step once we've identified unmet need to say, actually, can we quantify it and can we measure response to intervention?
How much do you think particularly an elderly person with Parkinson's disease, we need to be looking at the wider social aspect for the caregivers? How do we support the caregivers as part of the palliative care we provide?
That's an interesting question. I suppose it'll depend a lot on the context in which we're practicing medicine. In the UK at the moment, you know, accessing care is very difficult. And so I would say, I'm thinking back to my clinic last week, you know, we're often talking to people about planning for a bad day and building in enough resilience so that when that intercurrent illness comes along, there's some resilience there for caregivers. Because we don't have currently a system which can respond quickly enough to times of enhanced need. So there's that pragmatic aspect. How do we help relieve some of the burden's a loaded word, isn't it? Some of the implications of being a caregiver. And that often that might be very physical tasks. You know, how do we get people to help with getting your relative washed and dressed? And then the psychological aspect of that in terms of how do we make care acceptable? How do we make it something that isn't stigmatized? How do we make it something that people feel comfortable having? So they're very, very practical things, and that might include, for example, respite care, which in the UK would have two different forms. So you could have respite for a period of time where the person with Parkinson's perhaps goes to a care facility for a short period, a couple of weeks, while the carer goes away. In my experience, that's often not acceptable to people and actually doesn't work well because change of environment obviously is very tricky. But you could also divide that time up into a few hours per week, which gives the caregiver some relief to go and do other things. That can be really helpful. And then the sort of psychological and aspects of caring in terms of caregiver support groups. Different people have different attitudes to those as to whether they're acceptable to them or not. And then the big thing that we've found has been, again, this assimilation of loss and problems around anticipated grief and anticipated loss for caregivers. So we've had a link with our palliative care team in Bristol for PD for a few years. And we started off thinking that we'd be asking them lots of, you know, please, can you help us do an advanced care plan? But actually we do that in the vast majority of cases. And actually the questions that we ask from a caregiver perspective are often around support pre and post grief, pre and post bereavement. And this whole guilty thing about, you know, sense, you can't see air quotes, they come across well, do they? Sense, you know, someone going to a care home, you know, I sent him to a care home, and that the guilt that comes with that. So it's much more actually about that psychological support is what we've been referring for caregivers.
And is that particularly when people have the person with Parkinson's may have cognitive change? Is that an area that would be particularly difficult for the person with Parkinson's, but also for their carers, whether that's family carers or carers within a residential situation?
Yes. So it's clearly a time of increased need, isn't it? We know that caregiver burden's quite well associated with cognitive impairment, and all the implications of that, right? So sleep and being up in the night and washing bedclothes that are soiled, and as well as that sort of loss of previous relationships and grieving for, you know, the person that you had and the relationship that you had. Yes, so definitely. I suppose one might conceptualize it as someone losing their own support structure in terms of losing their partner at the same time as having this high level of practical responsibility. and I don't know how specific it is to the UK, but this, the socially still, for many older people in particular, the idea of going to a care home is hugely stigmatized. And people fight and fight and fight to try and keep someone at home. I don't mean fighting us, but fighting, you know, this, the disease and the process and the situation. And this, it's hugely, hugely burdensome for people. This responsibility to try and keep someone out of a care home at all costs, because that's been their longest held desire. And I have huge respect for them trying to do it, and we try and support them. But I do wonder at some of that is heavily to do with social stigma. So I don't know how well that translates into other European cultures.
Well, thank you for that. I think it's so complex, isn't it, of how carers cope with their caregiving and how they cope with the person who is deteriorating. And finally, if you were going to give one piece of advice on palliative care to a neurologist caring for people with Parkinson's disease, what would you suggest? What's one, or you could have two if you want, but a couple of pieces of advice.
Thanks. Can I say neurologist or geriatrician, David, just to make
or
me feel better?
Either.
I think the biggest thing is probably structure, isn't it? I think is structuring your service, which doesn't just mean your clinic, but the wider service, in a way that allows people to ask the question, that allows people to safely say, what's happening here, without thinking, oh, heck, my clinic's going to be 2 hours late and this is awful and I haven't got the skills to deal with the fallout. Because I think without that, we can't change, certainly we can't change to that wider whole disease model we were talking about. Because people, nobody wants to miss things. Nobody wants to be the doctor that doesn't pick up on something or the nurse that doesn't pick up on something. So actually we need a structure that says, I understand my own skill set. Maybe I'm interested in trying to expand my skill set so I can do more of this. Great. But I understand my own skill set. I understand the skill sets of the other people around me. And I have a structure in which it's safe to ask this question. And just to operationalize that slightly, you know, we did this when I was working in Leeds as a new consultant, was to have, we recognized that we had very, you know, like regular length appointments, but actually that meant it was very difficult to try and address some of these issues. So we set up a clinic run by a geriatrician, to me, where we had deliberately had longer appointments. And so the aim was that someone could ask the question, acknowledge the answer and say, right, we may not have time to deal with that today, but we're going to bring you back to this other setting where we will deal with it. And I think that can be sufficient to make it safe to ask the question. And then the second thing I think would be about having a framework of understanding of what palliative care is in for PD and how it can help. And that sounds like a slightly sort of funny answer, but it's some of the things we've talked about, having that, those points along the disease journey where I'm going to challenge myself to make sure I've been open and maybe, you know, gently ask the question.
Thank you. And I think the other thing I've heard you, as we've been talking, is collaboration with specialist palliative care providers, having the opportunity. And I always say, if neurologists don't know how to make that contact, you know, put a cup of coffee and a biscuit and a chance to meet up with people and talk about some of the issues and see if we can build up that collaboration between neurology and elderly care and specialist palliative care for the benefit of patients and families.
Absolutely. I'm sorry, I didn't mention that. So in the structure, when I was talking about structure, I guess I was focusing on that side of the divide, but absolutely. You have to have access to the specialist so that when you uncover a problem that you need help with, the help is there. Again, that's about enabling someone to ask the question safely. What we can't do is ask palliative care to do all of it. So making sure that we can safely ask for their help is vital. Yeah.
Thank you very much indeed. I hope that's given everyone a wider view of palliative care in Parkinson's disease. There is a webinar coming up from the AAN in the next week, so look out for that. If you're not able to attend the webinar, it will be available on the website. And certainly in the AAN specialty panel palliative care area, there is further information. And do contact us for further information. And think about palliative care when you're looking after someone with a neurological disease. Thank you very much indeed for everyone for listening, and thank you to Ed for giving us such a comprehensive overview of palliative care. Thank you.
Thanks, David.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.